Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very, very special mystery slash thriller writer. Her name is Val McDermid, and she has written a new book called Trick of the Dark, and it is out in all your bookstores now, published by Bywater Books. Hello.
Hi, David.
It's wonderful to talk to you.
Well, it's my pleasure entirely.
You're such a terrific writer. I mean, I feel honored just to be speaking to you right now.
Oh, please, you're making me blush.
We can't even see that, but you are blushing. Trick of the Dark.
I feel the heat.
You feel the heat?
You can probably feel the heat coming off my face.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote one of the, in my mind, one of the best mysteries of all time, called The Place of Execution. I don't know how many years ago that was.
But that was about 10 years ago now.
And in my mind, it is one of the best mysteries I've ever read in my life. And to this day, I still think about that book. And where do you get these fantastic ideas from?
Well, they generally start quite small. It's maybe something somebody says in passing, or a place that I visit that I think would make an interesting setting, or something that somebody tells me, or just something that I read in the newspapers. Not a crime story, because I don't use real crime stories as the basis for my books, but, you know, perhaps something other that makes me go, oh, that's interesting. It always starts with something that interests me, and then I start to play the what-if game with the thing that interests me and find out more information about it as I go along. And gradually, sort of story starts to emerge, sometimes with unlikely combinations of components, but it does eventually start to emerge, and that's when I can start to see what kind of story it is.
Now, this book's about Charlie Flynn. She's a disgraced psychiatrist. Now, when you write about psychiatrists, do you do all the background information on psychiatry? What do you do when you start writing a book like this?
I talk to people who do it for real. I've tried to read psychology and psychiatry textbooks, and by about page 10, I was completely baffled by science. And I thought, you know, I'm not smart enough or I don't have the right kind of mind to understand this stuff in textbooks. So, as usual, when I'm looking for how to do something or how to write about something, I go and find somebody who knows about it for real and talk to them. So I have a couple of people that I can explore ideas with and talk to about my ideas for stories.
Now, you write, and you have another series with forensic psychologist Dr. Tony Hill. It looks like you have about to publish your seventh book in that series, is that correct?
Yeah, it's coming out in the U.S. in January.
Now,
called Retribution.
And that's the one that's going to be published by Little Brown?
No, it's published by Little Brown in the U.K. It's published by Grove Atlantic in the U.S.
Oh, Grove Atlantic in the U.S. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. For some reason, I thought it was... I had the countries mixed up, I guess. But you seem to be fascinated with psychology.
I'm interested in what makes people do the things that they do. I'm interested in writing novels of character, and that means trying to get under the skin of why people do the things that they do. And in terms of police work and investigative work, it seems to me a fruitful avenue to pursue rather than just writing about police officers. It's slightly different for us, you see, in my country. In the U.S., you have the profiling done by FBI officers or police officers who are trained in behavioral science. But in the UK, we don't do it that way. What we do is we have clinical psychologists who work professionally in the field, often with serial offenders of one kind or another, and are then called in to consult with the police on individual cases. So already you have that dynamic tension between the non-police expert working with the police, which was quite fruitful for a writer of fiction, I think.
Right. Now, Trick of the Dark, which is very heavily a lesbian-themed novel, which I found very interesting. You don't read a lot of novels like that, a lot of mysteries where there's a heavy lesbian element to them.
Well, there's a strong tradition of lesbian mystery writing, but it doesn't generally end up in the mainstream.
Right.
I didn't sit down when I started writing this, but I didn't sit round to specifically write a lesbian novel. And it isn't a lesbian novel in the sense that it's not about issues of being a lesbian as such.
Right.
It's not about, you know, being a lesbian's a problem, how do I deal with that?
Right.
It's a set of characters who happen to be lesbian and who pursue, or the story is pursued through their lives. And when I was working up the story, when I was trying to make sense of the idea and figure it out, it occurred to me that most of the relationships at the heart of this book are triangular. And it's much easier to make credible triangular relationships if all the people involved in the triangle have the same sort of sexuality, if they're all lesbian, in other words. Then it kind of makes sense. The triangle works much better, if you see what I mean, as a sort of construction than otherwise. And so it kind of became clear to me when I was composing the story, a part of it, that the story would actually work much better if the characters were gay.
Right. So it's interesting. Writers seem to know where to go with the story, what's going to make the story seem what's going to make the story work the most.
Yeah, a lot of it's trial and error. I mean, but certainly a lot of the way I work is trial and error. You know, I mean, I'm trying out various possibilities in my head, and you end up with what feels satisfying in a narrative sense. I mean, you try pushing the story in one direction and see if it works, and if it works, then fine, go with it and see where you can take it after that. But if it doesn't work, then you just kind of backtrack to where it was still working and move in a different direction and see where that takes you. So a lot of it, before I start writing, a lot of the kind of planning that's going on in my head is precisely that, figuring out what is a satisfying story here.
And like you did with Place of Execution, which has the most stunning ending I think I've ever read in a mystery. I mean, it's just so unexpected and yet satisfying at the same time, which is very hard to do. I mean, I read a lot of books, and I don't read a lot that have really wonderfully stunning and surprising endings. Do you like doing that?
Well, that's very flattering of you to say so. But, I mean, I think I always try to keep something up my sleeve for the end of the book, so that there is a moment where the reader will go, oh my God, I didn't see that coming.
Right, and is that fun?
Yeah, but the thing is that one of the problems, I think, for contemporary crime writers is that you're dealing with a very sophisticated readership. Most of the people who read my books read a lot of crime novels. They're very well versed in the genre. And so they kind of sometimes develop an instinct almost, a sense of where the book's going. And I have to, while I'm trying to keep sort of something at the end that will make the reader sort of step back in amazement kind of thing, I have to be conscious of the fact that it will be, for some of my readers, they'll have figured that out by page 50. And what I have to concentrate on is making the journey of the book interesting enough that they want to come with me, even though they think they know where it's going. So I've got the task of writing characters, writing situations that the reader can't put down, can't walk away from, even though they think they know where they're going.
I love that. You have some really amazing scenes in this book, because there's one scene with a woman who's totally ostracized by her father for being a lesbian, and it's such a powerful scene. When I first read it, I came away feeling this intense sadness for this character, you know, and empathy, thinking, well, wow, what she's been through, you know, and I really felt that very deeply. And you have a knack for really letting the reader feel those emotions for these characters.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what I'm always trying to do. And I think for a writer, one of the things, if you're serious at all about your writing, you're always trying to become better, to become more competent. And one of the aspect of that is, I suppose, learning how to walk in other people's shoes. And that's something that, you know, most of us, it takes a little while and a little practice to be able to do that. And I think that's why most people's first novels tend to be quite close to their lives. And I don't necessarily mean in terms of the facts of the setting and the situation of the characters, but in emotional and psychological terms, I think we tend to write quite close to ourselves when we're starting out. And then gradually, as we develop more confidence and we develop more skills, it becomes possible to imagine ourselves inside the lives of other people, inside the skin of other people, to think, well, if I was that person, how would I feel? How is that different from how I would feel?
So you have to put yourselves in the character's shoes. The characters have to feel real to you as a writer, too.
Yeah.
Completely real.
A lot of that comes from observation. It comes from, like, you know, scrutinizing the people in your life, your friends, your family, and also people with whom you have fleeting encounters. But it's always trying to kind of build a database in your head of how people behave and what their reactions are and what that seems to you to indicate inside them. So it's about listening, and it's about watching, and it's about filing everything away for when you might need it. I think writers are kind of, we're kind of cannibals, really. We eat our own lives, and then we eat everybody else's lives around us.
Right, yeah. And I love the way you, I mean, your books, some of your books tend to be a little bit on the, shall we say, bloody side? Or would gory be a better word, or is that...
Well, I would say dark. I mean, I think, yeah, the thing is, with the Tony Hill novels, you're dealing with a character who reads a crime scene differently from the way the rest of us read it. It seems somehow dubious, really, to not show the reader what he's seeing, to not let the reader draw their own conclusions from what he's seeing and what he's analysing. And I also think, you know, murder isn't a parlour game. The crime novel is no longer the neat little crossword puzzle where, you know, bloodlessly it gets solved and nobody really gets hurt along the way. I think we need to take cognizance of the fact that violent sudden death is a terrible thing, that it contaminates all the lives it comes into contact with. And as crime writers, we need to be honest about what it is and what it does. And in some of my books, that takes the shape of looking very directly at an act of violence and seeing what it is. It's a difficult line between giving the reader the information that I think they ought to be confronted with and writing that becomes just gratuitously violent, a sort of pornography, a sort of glamorizing of death. Right. And I try very hard to stay on the right side of the line. But I think that what my job is to suggest enough for the reader's imagination to do the rest. And if you actually look at my books where I do deal quite directly with violence, I think what you'll see is that I write very little, and that actually most of what happens between the ears of the reader. It happens inside their heads.
And I mean, Trick of the Dark is very, very psychologically based. It's not gory at all. There's no gore. There's very little blood even in the book.
Yeah, most of what happens off stage because it doesn't fit with the tone of that book and the style of that book. It's a different kind of book. And that's one of the things I love about contemporary crime fiction is that there is really so much range of possibilities, the different kinds of book you can write, the different voice. And so for me, it becomes possible to tell whatever story is clamouring to be heard. I'm not confined by, say, having a police inspector or a private eye, where you can only tell certain kinds of stories, and other kinds of stories are off limits because they're not the kind of stories those people would investigate.
Right. Now, there's a memoir. A woman is writing a memoir all through this book, and the things you actually have the pages of the memoir in the book, which is very interesting because I find those passages absolutely captivating to read. I found myself looking forward to those passages again to see what was going to happen next to this woman.
Oh, thank you. Maybe I should have written her memoir as well.
It really is effective because for some reason it's even more real than the rest of the story to me. I don't know why that was, but I found myself just being totally caught up in, you know, what's going to happen next to this woman.
Well, I think that's because it's the first person and it's a kind of ventriloquism, you know, and it's very immediate for that reason. First person writing always does feel that much more immediate. But I think it's you know, the idea of a book within a book is something, as you know, I've done before. And it took me a long time to figure out how to tell the story, what the structure for the story was going to be.
Right.
And ultimately, the penny finally dropped because I couldn't figure out why this particular character would be going back into her past and revealing her past and talking about her past. And I didn't want to do it as a series of flashbacks, which seemed to be both lazy and not illuminating enough. And it was only really when the sort of spate of misery memoir started to hit the market that I thought, now that might be a way to do it.
Right.
And so what had been a pretty intractable problem of structure was resolved by that happening. So sometimes you just have to wait for the world to come round to your way of thinking and provide you with a solution to your problems of narrative.
And then Charlie Flynn is like the main character in this book, and she's investigating this. Well, why don't you describe the book a little bit for somebody who hasn't read it yet?
Well, Charlie Flint is not doing the thing that she does best, which is working as a clinical psychiatrist. She's doing a bit of lecturing in other areas, but she's pretty fed up. And then she gets a package in the post of newspaper cuttings about a murder trial that's taking place in London. And as she reads the cuttings, she gradually realizes that she in fact knows the widow of the murder victim, and guesses who might have sent her these newspaper cuttings, it turns out to be someone who was her tutor years ago when she herself was an undergraduate. And she goes off to Oxford to talk to her former tutor to find out why she's been sent this package of cuttings. And of course it turns out that the tutor thinks the people on trial are innocent and wants Charlie to investigate. And Charlie's not very keen on investigating for all sorts of reasons, but it's almost like she's got nothing better to do at the time, and it is quite intriguing. So she starts to follow the clues to see where they lead her. And they lead her down a very twisted path that involves a lot of history, the individual lives at the heart of the book. And really, the central character, apart from Charlie, is a woman called J. McAllen Stewart. And we never know till the very end of the book whether J is actually a psychopathic serial killer or someone around whom unfortunate things happen. Right. And that, I suppose, is the mystery in the book. I suppose the trick of the dark of the title is the fact that, really, in this book, everybody lies about some things. They lie to themselves, they lie to other
people. Sounds like real life to me.
Yeah. it's like Dr. House says, isn't it? Everybody lies. And the reader's job is to figure out who's lying about what and when they're lying and when they're telling the truth.
Now, do you get as much fun writing the books as we do reading them?
Some days it's fun, but I will be honest and say that most days it's hard work. It's a case of just sort of sitting there and getting the words on the page.
Well, what do you do when it becomes... does it ever become overwhelmingly hard? And what do you do to combat that? And what... I mean, do you eat or do you... what do you do?
I don't know that it ever gets overwhelmingly hard. It's just, you know, it's a tough job, and some days are better than others, like any job.
Right.
You know, I have... It's the one thing in the world that I can do well. And so, I mean, I constantly remind myself that I'm very lucky to be able to do this for a living when, you know, an awful lot of people would give their right arm to do what I do for a living. What I tend to do to sort of loosen my head up is to go and take the dog for a walk on the beach. I live by the sea in the north of England, and so I go and take a little walk on the beach, or I play some computer games or something completely different that seems to free up the creative part of my head. And so it's about letting your subconscious do the work, I suppose, you know, like letting your conscious mind focus on other things, and setting your subconscious the puzzle to work with.
Right. I mean, you look at the... your place of execution, the Anthony Award for Best Mystery, the Barry Award for Best British Crime, the Cavity Award for Best Novel. I mean, all in the same year you won all these awards. What, you really are a terrific, really great mystery writer. And how does that feel to know that you are? Or don't you know that you are?
Well, I don't know that I am in the sense that you're talking about. I mean, and I don't say this out of a sense of false modesty. You know, whenever I finish a book, my overwhelming feeling is dissatisfaction, because I feel that I've not achieved what I wanted to achieve when I set out. You know, I think when you start writing a book, you have sort of the perfect book in your head, you know, the platonic ideal book, I suppose. You know, you have the perfect marriage of character and quality of the prose and the setting and the storytelling. And sometimes, some days it feels like every sentence you put on the page takes you further away from that ideal. And when you finally let it go, it's the best I could do on the day. You know, I'm even after 25 novels, I'm still ambitious for my work. I want to get better. I want every book to be better, or at least different, to be challenging, in a way that the previous ones weren't.
Well, it sounds like to me that you set the bar really high for yourself, and that, well, I mean, will you ever achieve the perfect novel in your mind?
Probably not, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't keep trying.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, I mean, that's the excitement of it. That's what keeps me.
Well, see, I think
keeps me fresh.
Right, I think Place of Execution is a perfect novel. I really believe that.
I'm not sure.
Because now, I mean,
one of two things. There was a little bit at the ending and the final, when I first wrote it, the draft before the final one, I had a sort of final line that I really, really liked. My editor thought was too pretentious, but I still really like it. But there you go.
Now, do you listen to your editors all the time? I mean, are they always right, or are they sometimes, do you sometimes battle with them and say, no, I'm right and you're wrong?
Well, I don't really have that kind of relationship with my editors. I mean, I think the relationship with your editor should be a relationship of trust. That they're somebody that you, whose opinion you respect. The editor's job is to help you to make your book better. And my editor certainly is not the prescriptive kind of editor. He doesn't go like, you need to change that, this must be like this, and this must be like that. What he tends to do, and this is the kind of editing that works for me, is he puts his finger on what he sees are the weaknesses in the book. And then we talk about it. And I would say 9 times out of 10, the things that he picks up on are things that I already know are not right. But they've been the best I could do on the day that I handed the first draft in. And in the process of discussing it, usually it becomes clear to me what I can do to resolve the situation. And so that's kind of how we work.
Right, now how was Trick of the Dark? Were there any problems writing Trick of the Dark? And I'm wondering, as the process, do you always plan the book out totally in advance, or is it as you go along? How does
no,
that work?
I have a sort of overall, I have an overall story arc in my head, and some of the sort of key points along the way, I know what they are, but a lot of it just, it happens as it happens, you know, as I go along, the incidental detail, if you like, becomes much clearer to me as I'm working. But I know what I'm working towards in sort of the overall arc of the story, and also sort of say the individual key points along the way. But I mean, with Trick of the Dark, I think I don't think there was very much to do with Trick of the Dark, really. I think I was more or less there first time. I've been doing this so long now. What tends to happen for me in rewrite these days is that the book gets longer. Because when I'm writing the first draft, I'm always stripping it back, trying to get rid of any unnecessary material. And so what happens sometimes is that along the way I actually strip out something the reader needs to know. And I think I've told them, and I think it's there in the book, but actually I haven't. So generally my books gain about 10,000 words in rewrite.
Interesting. Where are you most popular? Which country is your most biggest selling place? I mean, where...
Well, apart from like the UK, I mean, I'm very, very popular in Germany. I do very well in France also, and in Scandinavia and in Japan.
And how about the United States? I think you're getting really well known in the United States, if not already.
Well, I think it's building
already.
In the United States. It's a tough battle in the United States for British writers, I think. I mean, it's hard to think of, you know, a single British mystery writer who's sort of, you know, sort of up there in the New York Times bestseller list regularly and you know, doing well in comparison with the best of American writers. I'm not quite sure. I think part of the problem that we have is that I think a lot of American readers have very firmly fixed in their head the sort of Agatha Christie world, you know, which is reinforced by the television adaptations, the very good television adaptations, which gives them a kind of picture of what they think the UK is like.
Right.
And I think they're not entirely comfortable sometimes with the reality of life in the UK, where unfortunately it's dirty and nasty and as messy as it can be in the US. And also the other thing is, I mean, I think is, you know, you've got so many good American mystery writers. You know, I could cheerfully read an American mystery every week for a year and not feel that I'd missed out.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's a hard sell to try and persuade readers to read British writers when they're really writing something that, although in some ways it's very similar, in other ways it's very, very different. And you probably have to work a wee bit harder because you're looking at a different culture.
Exactly. I find myself, I mean, I love reading British mystery writers. I love reading about Brit. I love reading out of everything about them. And I just, and not that I don't get a lot from the American ones. I mean, I think of Elizabeth George, and I love Elizabeth George, and everybody thinks she's British, and she really is from the United States. And
I will say one thing, David. The Brits don't think she's British.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, the Brits very definitely don't think she's British.
Right. Now, you, Stieg Larsson actually read your books.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Now, did you ever hear from him?
Well, no, because, I mean, he died before he was first published.
Right. I mean, did you ever get any fan mail from him?
Not that I'm aware of.
Right. I think that's fascinating that he actually read your books and enjoyed your books, but... I mean, you are very, very good at what you do. I mean, obviously, in 25 novels, that's an incredible achievement. Now, you're getting some kind of award at the BAFTAcon. Tell me about this award you're getting.
Well, I've been international guest of honor
here
at the BAFTAcon this year, which is the World Mystery Convention. And that's been, you know, a huge honor, really, to be chosen. You know, I mean, there's only one person a year who gets that honour, and for it to be me was just, I was blown away by that, really. Along the way, I picked up another Barry Award for Fever of the Bone.
Wow, very cool.
Which was most unexpected, things, because I hadn't, when the list of nominees for the awards came out, I'd just looked at the list for Best British Mystery and thought, oh, well, I'm not on that, never mind. I'm obviously not going to win anything this year. But what I hadn't actually read down the list to the paperback original, because, of course, when Fever of the Bone was published in the US, it was published as a paperback original. And wow. So it was only on the afternoon before the awards were being given out that the editor of Deadly Pleasures magazine said to me, "Ah, and I hope you'll be at the awards ceremony tonight. You know, you'd be silly to miss it."
Right.
And I'm like, well, I was planning on being there anyway, but yeah, okay. And then I realized that I'd actually won it.
I find it fascinating that you really have this view of yourself that you can always be better. And I guess that's good as a writer to feel that there's always something better you can do than what you're doing. But I mean, I still read your books, and I really think you're brilliant in a lot of ways. Now, are there flaws with the books? Maybe. I don't see them. But as a reader, I so enjoy your books that maybe I overlook them. Maybe I... But I don't notice them, and they don't bother me. But there are some readers who take every word you say and will analyze it and tell you if you're wrong. You know, but what I mean, I'm just wondering how you see yourself. Obviously, you don't want to get real full of yourself. I mean, how do you look at that?
Well, I mean, I think I see myself as somebody who is a lot further down the line of mastering their craft than I was when I set out. Yeah, I look at my early books and I look at what I'm writing now, and I think there's, you know, sort of a huge gulf between them of ambition and achievement. But, you know, I also feel there's a way to go. You know, as I say, every book I look at, I can see things that I would have done differently or could have achieved better. You know, a scene that perhaps could have been done more subtly, or an interaction where I've done too much. I should have done less. Or sometimes I should have done more. So there's always those kind of you know, attention to detail stuff that makes me hungry to be better, hungry to get it more right next time, I suppose.
And especially in Trick of the Dark, I find myself, I mean, with some of your characters I just enjoy hating so much. I look at Corinna and I think, oh, I hate this woman. I hate what she just did. And, you know, I sort of enjoy that. I mean, is that sound sick to say that?
Well, no, but I mean, I take that as a testament to my abilities to create a character, that you actually care enough to dislike her, you know.
But at the same time, she changes over the course of the years, though, which is interesting. Her character becomes much, much less vehement about in her beliefs as she gets older. She seems to mellow out a bit.
Well, I think people do. I mean, I think it's a nonsense to say that people don't change over time. You know, people have the capacity to change. And
well, how have you changed over the years?
How have I changed? I have become much mellower. You know, for various reasons, I was always very driven. I was very, very much an overachiever. You know, I always had to be the best, the youngest, the first. And it really took me, I suppose, till I got to about 50 to actually say, like, you know what? It's okay. You can calm down. You can relax a bit, you know? Just, you know, enjoy it.
Are you happy with your success now? I mean, is it better or...
I'm very happy with my life in general. I mean, I'm very contented. You know, I have a happy home life. I have a good professional life. That's not the same as being complacent. It doesn't mean you just sit back and go, well, everything's fine now, I can just relax.
Right.
I mean, the thing about, you know, having good things in your life is that it makes you understand that you have to work at keeping them in a good place. That sitting on your hands and just hoping everything will carry on an even keel is not an option.
Right.
Now, it's like you have to work at your relationships, you have to work at, you know, your writing as well.
Right. It's good to hear you're happy overall, and yeah, you work hard, but working hard is a challenge, and to constantly have a challenge in your life like that's got to feel really good.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the one thing that I would, you know, quite like is to travel a little less.
Right.
You know, most people, you know, when they look at my travel schedule, they think, oh, that's really exciting. You know, you're off to Ireland, to America, to wherever, you know, to Brussels next week and then Belfast on the weekend. And people look at that and they think that's glamorous, that's really exciting. But you know what? After a certain time, another airport, another hotel, another city, it just starts to become something you could live without.
Well, can you write while you're traveling?
I do write when I'm traveling, when I'm in that phase, when I'm in that cycle of the year. But that's not the point, really. The point is, you're sort of being dragged from pillar to post, it's tiring, and you're away from your family, and you're away from all the things that make you rooted in your life, I suppose.
Absolutely. Now, I first met you, and the only time I met you was at Swarthmore College in Springfield, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And do you remember that day?
I do. I remember. It was a fantastic event.
And I
so enjoyed that.
And I went to, I knew you were going to be there, and I thought, I've got to go meet her, because this place of execution was just fantastic. And I remember when I met you, my first impression was, this is just a really nice human being.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so. It's amazing how deceptive appearances can be.
Well, I mean, we see your face, your picture on your book covers, and you think, oh, she looks like she's in a bad mood. But a lot of times it's just the way that the publisher wants to take the picture or whatever. You're all at the publisher's whim as far as what they want to put on a book. But
Nobody ever wants a crime writer to look happy.
Yeah.
But so whenever the photographers come to do a photo shoot for an article, or just, for file pictures, they always want you to look serious into the camera. They don't want, like this grinning maniac, You can smile if you write romantic fiction, but not if you're a crime writer.
Now, do you find yourself fascinated by true crime?
No, not at all. I'm not really interested in reading true crime, with a few exceptions that where you would actually go to it for the quality of the writing, the book that Gordon Byrne wrote about the Yorkshire Ripper, someone's husband, someone's son. But in general, no. I think when I was a journalist, I saw at close range the effect of sudden violent death on people's lives. And I think that if you use real cases as the basis for your fiction, you run the risk of causing more pain and grief where, frankly, there's already been enough pain and grief.
Right.
And I would rather trust to my imagination in these circumstances and not use real cases. The other thing I think is that sometimes we're not always aware of what the truth is in a real case. We don't really know what's going on, however much there is in the media. And I think sometimes it could be possible that you could actually cut across lines of police inquiry, for example, with an old case or a cold case, without even realizing that's what you were doing.
I'm wondering about Retribution that's coming out in January. Can you give us a real quick plot description?
Well, several books back, in a book called The Wire in the Blood, Tony Hill and Carol Jordan came face to face with probably the darkest and coldest psychopath of their careers, a guy called Jacko Vance, who had been a sports star and had become a television presenter, but was also a serial killer of young women. And they captured Jacko Vance and he went to jail. And at the start of this book, The Retribution, Jacko Vance escapes from jail and he has an agenda. He intends to make the people that he blames for his incarceration pay the price. And it's not something as simple as killing them that he has in mind.
So how do you get into the mind of a killer like that? I mean, how do you write it so effectively that it all seems real? What do you do? Do you talk to people that have seen people like that, or what do you do?
Yeah, I do. I do talk to psychologists who've worked in prison with or in secure mental hospitals with people like that. But I also, it's about using your imagination. It's trying to imagine what would be going on inside the head of someone who is driven in this way to do these things. What would it feel like to have that kind of drive inside you? So it's always about trying to walk in somebody else's shoes, trying to sort of jump out of your own world into their world. And in some ways, it's no more difficult to imagine myself in the shoes of a psychopathic killer than it is to imagine myself in the shoes of someone like Tony Hill, who is, the hunter rather than the prey. Because, he has a very different mindset to mine as well. He looks at the world through different eyes. So it's all about that it's about learning to exercise your imagination. And I sort of think of the imagination really as being a bit like a muscle. It's one of those things, the more you exercise it, the stronger it gets.
Right. Well, you've certainly had a strong imagination over the years, 25 novels, and you're just at the top of your game as far as I'm concerned. You just keep getting hitting the mark on all these books. It's got to be, I mean, it's great for us, the readers, and it must be great for you.
Well, it's just a case of keeping on at it, you know, because these stories are in my head, but they don't tell themselves. You know, I have to actually get out there and get them done.
Right. Now, I know you have to go, so we're going to let you go, but this has been an absolute pleasure. I mean, Trick of the Dark is wonderful. I think everybody's going to enjoy it. It's in actually paperback in the United States? Or
yes, it's trade paper.
Trade paper. And the new one, The Retribution, that's coming in January. It looks like January 10th of next year.
Yeah.
So we have that to look forward to. We have plenty to look forward to. Now, what are you working on now?
I'm working on next year's book, which will be... it's a standalone novel. It's a thriller, and it's called The Vanishing Point.
Oh.
And that will be out in September next.
Can you tell us anything about that at all?
Well, the book opens in an airport where a woman is going through security with a young child, and she sets off the metal detector alarm, so she has to go inside the Perspex box so that she can be wanded. And the kid is standing by the luggage belt because they don't let your kid come inside the box with you. And while she's standing inside the box, somebody walks up to her kid, takes him by the hand, and walks off with the kid.
Wow.
And, of course, she tries to get out of the box, but, of course, they misunderstand her actions, and she's wrestled to the ground, and because she won't stop fighting, she's eventually tasered. And by the time she comes round, the kid is long gone.
Right. Well,
that's where the book starts.
We'll look forward to that. I know you have to go, so I don't want to keep you any longer. The book, again, is called Trick of the Dark. It's out from Bywater Books. It's in all your bookstores now, and I hope you all enjoy it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. This has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.